You're listening to the Vocal Fry Podcast, your weekly dash of voice science, pedagogy, and pop culture. Coming to you from the fields of Trenzalore, where the doctor stands.
All right, Vocal Fam, we are here with the myth, the legend, basically, I don't know, Sarah, what would we call him? I don't know. King of acoustic vocal pedagogy, Ken Bozeman. Ken is a great fan of great friend of the podcast, and we are excited to welcome him back. So, Ken, welcome back to Vocal Fry.
It's great to be here. Thank you. I'm just the old guy. I'm the old guy.
You're far more than that. You are our fearless leader for acoustic vocal pedagogy and other things. Ken, it's really great to have you back. I don't think that many of our listeners would necessarily not know who you are, but at the same time, you know what? It dawned upon me this morning I didn't realize it had been as long as it's been since we've had you on the podcast.
I was going to say, I think the last time might have been when I was a student and we were sitting in JPW.
It was. Yeah. And now you're on the faculty.
All right.
What in the world?
And Joanne was in that one as well.
Yes.
It was. And they hadn't even released the book yet.
Right.
It just had not occurred to me that it's been 2.5 years since you've actually been on Vocal Fry. I had no idea. I guess it's just my pandemic brain.
Time is weird.
COVID time has been crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Has it been 3 months? Has it been 3 years? I don't even know.
We're always saying, it's Friday again. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Right. And it actually, Vocal Fam, it actually is Friday again, which is why we're here. I wanted Ken to come on to be able to talk about the new version of kinesthetic voice pedagogy, which I guess you did actually. I thought it was just the second edition, but you actually did put a 2 by it on the cover.
That was Scott McCoy's way of identifying it. He did that with his own publications. You knew he'd have his Inside View 2 and so forth and so on. So
it is helpful when you go to buy because it's like it's right there on the front. You know you're getting the right one.
Yep,
I appreciated it.
Yep. Well, there you go. So anyway, but before we do that, Ken, just the 30-second version, remind the Vocal Fam who you are, since it's been a while.
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm a voice teacher. That's what I am. I'm not a voice scientist. I'm a sort of a so-so scholar, but I am a serious voice teacher. And I've studied pedagogy, and I've studied voice science. And I taught for 43 years at Lawrence University, undergraduate-only conservatory of music. And during that time, observed a few things that have turned out to be useful. So I've written a few articles and a couple of books on that. And now in my retirement, my current mission in life professionally is to spread this information to anybody that's interested. So that's basically it.
Absolutely. And also our fearless leader of acoustic vocal pedagogy workshop at New England Conservatory.
Right.
Okay, so Ken, first, I guess here's where I'd like to start. Let's say someone only knows your work from Practical Vocal Acoustics, because that came out in what, 2013 or 14?
Yeah, 13.
13. So let's say someone's read Practical Vocal Acoustics, but maybe they've not read either version of kinesthetic voice pedagogy. They had never gotten to that, which I think you would say probably has more application of ideas than from PVA?
Right.
So what are some basic things that are kind of in this version of the book that were not in PVA? Give us an example of something that was one of the practical application things that is included in this.
Okay. So, even though the first book said Practical Vocal Acoustics, Pedagogic Applications for Teachers and Singer, I waded in there, but at that point, it was my first book, and I was really trying to stay close to the voice science and not write anything that I couldn't sort of, you know, vet a little bit, back up a little bit from that resource. And I was in I was actually doing a master class for Ian in New England Conservatory in about 2015. And he said, so when are you going to write another book? And I said, well, I don't know what I'd write about. He said, you got to write about all the stuff you're doing in the studio. And I said, you mean my touchy-feely stuff? My touchy-feely stuff? And he said, yeah, that's what the teachers want to know. And I said, okay, I'll think on that, because I was a little nervous about going out with basically pedagogic ideas that aren't entirely vetted. They grow out of my understanding of voice science, but they're not entirely vetted. So I sat down and I wrote a list of things that I could do. Anyway, so I wrote the second book. Well, that's continued to evolve. So now the KVP2 is about twice as long, 150 pages versus 87 pages, and has 14 chapters versus 8 chapters and a lot of new things. But to give you an example, one of the things that I elaborate in much more detail in the second book, so this is the stuff that how I translate this information in the studio. It's based on the practical the understanding of the theory from PVA, and a little bit more in this one too, actually. I continue to reveal theory, and particularly I've incorporated a great deal more of Ian's great work on spectral tone, color, auditory roughness. We're very indebted to Ian's work in those areas, and will continue to be. Anyway, so Chiaroscuro Whisper, which I've thrown some YouTube things up on, is basically how you can populate the vocal tract with a noise that contains every frequency, and it'll completely reveal the formant structure, and the resonance structure and the formants of the vocal tract. Understanding, you know, what we see on spectrographs and so forth are formants, you know, the radiated sound, but they don't exactly match the resonances of the vocal tract depending on what you're running through there. Well, if you run a noise through there that has all these frequencies, it'll completely populate the resonant structure of the vocal tract. So what you see is what you get. In other words, what you see on the spectrogram is pretty much what you got in the vocal tract. Then you can then feel, because there's a little bit of turbulence, you can sort of feel and sense how you're tuning those resonances and play with them. Why chiaroscuro? Because that's a sort of a neutral to a settled, with slightly open throat, maybe set up like a classical singer, rather than the typical whisper, which is more in response to our innate response to our acoustic landscape. We innately cheat towards the high frequencies, right, in nature, you know, in the wild. So when we yell or when we whisper, we tend to go very high frequency dominant. That's not the way we ought to be singing classical. So the chiaroscuro whisper takes the whisper back to a more of a neutral larynx setup, and it plays the lower end of the spectrum as well as the higher end of the spectrum, so you can really study how it feels. So there's a whole chapter on that, and there, actually there's an appendix which you can actually download actually from kenbosom.com that details chiaroscuro whisper with a bunch of videos that go along with it and so forth. So that's in there.
So you were actually, give us a real life example here, you know, because I'm just thinking of class this week, now that the semester has started again and, you know, interacting with students, and as Sarah will tell you, we always have our discussion questions in class, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And one of them was asking right away about, like, you know, but what about, can any of this information really help a singer? In a lesson, how might you use chiaroscuro whisper in when you're vocalizing and to prepare for it, or if they were preparing for a phrase in a song, how might you use that concept literally practically in the teaching?
Right. So I'll try to think of an example. Well, you can use it a variety of ways. I'll start with a simple one, then I'll go to a more complicated one. They make a sound, and maybe they make a sound, they say, ah, and I say, well, you know, that's not a very balanced sound. It's sort of mouthy, a little bit high larynx, not tight, but a little bit narrow pharynxed. And if I say, if you whisper through that, ah, you get that sound. I want you to get, and I have to teach them how to do that, because it is not instinctive. The total instinct is to do the typical whisper, yeah, right. And so I want them to do, shape an ah, but you're going to hear a lot more of the complementary vowel, which in this case will sound to you, it's literally an O, but it'll sound like an yeah, yeah. and it'll feel very soothing and easy in the neck. Yaw. Use expression. Don't do deadpan. Yaw. Because voice is played by expression. Full stop. Everything I do, if I can get there that way, that's how I get there.
Sarah, if we do a clip show from season 5 and 6, make sure I play that quote.
All over.
No, that quote right there. That quote about expression. Anyway.
But that's how we do it. That's how it's programmed from birth, pre-language. I mean, babies are making all kinds of sounds. They're not worried about what vowel they're making. And they make them all over their range. They don't chase a particular vowel target up and down the range. They just let them happen. Anyway, so I would reorient there and have them say, instead of doing yah, 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 now sing me through that feeling, yah, ah, for example. Second, more complicated one, active vowel modification. Because you can specify the pitches of a chiaroscuro whisper, which, by the way, Nick, what started me on this path was 2.5 years ago when I was there with you in Mississippi College, or maybe it was online with your bass. I can't remember which it was, whether it was live or online.
It was live.
So I was showing your lovely bass that you had there, the chiaroscuro whisper, and he was doing the same pitch as I do. And I said, wait a minute. Do that again. Because from all of the science, I expected everybody's formants to be different based on tube length. All right? That's where the science was, still is. And he was, when he was going for the auditory targets, the vowel targets that I was feeding him, he was reproducing the pitches that I was. So it was basically this. Anyway, when you do the right one, it'll tune right to the right pitch per vowel or pretty darn close to it. It takes some work and some training. And at first I thought, well, will this work for sopranos with shorter tubes? Yeah, I got one I posted it on YouTube. Now, it takes some work because they have the smaller pharynxes, so there's the tendency to feel it a little differently until they sort it, but there should be no laryngeal depressing or anything like that. Anyway, so active vowel modification. So if I find the auditory target, the pitch and the vowel timbre of the target vowel of, say, an E vowel, which, as you know, there's a full chapter on in KVP2,
Pause for just a second. Also, I'd like to publicly thank Ken Bozeman for my E vowel. You're welcome, everyone in the world who didn't care about this statement. But moving back, I was singing lovely. I was making some really great sounds. But Ken fixed my E vowel, and I'm very grateful for it.
All of us pretty much have had to work on that E vowel in certain parts of the range. At any rate, so you can find the auditory target of an E vowel, which is it's B6. Normal pitch, and it'll be very clear. Then open the mouth while continuing to chase that auditory target. And you open your mouth as wide as is comfortable. Basically, that's the only limit, is comfort. Okay? You can open the mouth very wide on an E vowel, and it always helps it if you're going high. And you keep reproducing. Now, if I speak through that, you will hear what a strange modification it is. Here's my regular one, E. Here's my one with my mouth opened. E, E, E. What the heck is that? That's a good shape for an E vowel on a high note. That's what that is. And you can find it, and you can find what it feels like. E, E, E. And you can learn the feel of that before you sing it, because everybody tries to go E up high and they strangle.
I've never encountered that with anyone before. No, absolutely. Now, I would like to point out, Vocal Fam, since you can't see Ken right now,
oh, that's true.
That at all times as he was demonstrating that demonstration, his tongue dorsum remains relatively high toward the hard palate while he does that, which I would like to add, from then incorporating this into my own teaching, is a critical part of this, that the tongue dorsum does not just go along with the jaw. Rather, it's the sort of sides stay in contact with those molars. And then there's something actually, you know, this actually gets us into this edition of KVP2. You put a little section in there on this, and it's the first time I had seen you write on it. Talk a little bit about the tip of the tongue for us.
Sure. So I'm going to revisit what you just said about the tongue dorsum lowering.
Please.
And I mentioned that, of course, in that chapter. If you lower the tongue, you will not hit the auditory target. So one of the ways of, I mean, you can do it either way. You can do it biomechanically, saying keep your tongue dorsum high, which I do say, okay, I say that. Or you can say, keep repeating,
right.
Watch me lower my tongue, or hear me tongue. It's no longer the same pitch.
Right.
Yeah.
That pitch will determine whether or not it's going to sound like an E.
Yep.
When you sing through it. So that's, so there are several ways of getting that tongue dorsum to stay high, either talking about it and pointing out that it's going to be touching the upper molars on either side. It's going to feel really, it will feel like your tongue is in the way. It will feel like you're singing through tongue, maybe even behind and under tongue. And I learned, this was really cool, I was working with a soprano in Sweden who had lived in Italy for a while. And I said, yeah, it's going to feel like you're singing under your tongue. He said, the Italians say that. Cantare sotto la lingua. Sing under the tongue. I said, really? Oh, great. I love that. So anyway.
Well, I will say that idea for my tenors, but also particularly for my sopranos.
Oh, yeah.
For some of my, and I've been very fortunate that in this online world, I have some pretty darn fancy high-level sopranos that have started working with me. And, you know, being married to a soprano like you are, I kind of thought, well, I kind of understand the soprano voice and, you know, always thought, I've done pretty well with sopranos. Let me tell you what that E vowel difference has made.
Oh, yeah.
Because E is already a pretty comfortable vowel for them.
Yep.
But when they start to experience the fact that E is coming under the tongue and then relate that to the sensation of ah going back up and over the tongue for the middle voice and the upper passaggio. Y'all, vocal fam, y'all don't even know. Anyway, so I mean that's been a really great impact on my teaching.
Yeah. It's huge. And so I usually will start with the E vowel with treble voices, because once they figure out that high tongue position for that, all the other front vowels would just spin off of that. And then they want to try to keep some of that, as you said, in the ah, so they don't really drop the tongue further than they have to for an
exactly.
ah. Now, back to the question you asked, tongue tip.
Yes.
And this, you know, there's always more to learn, and I'm still learning. I've actually learned some things since even KVP2. You know, I don't think I'm going to do another edition, but you know, just more more touchy-feely stuff, right? More studio stuff. But the standard pedagogy to talk about keeping the tip of the tongue to the lower teeth, because we don't want a real tensely retracted tongue into the body of, you know. So it's generally good advice, but it insisting on it in all circumstances can get you into trouble, depending on your morphology, your tongue length, and so forth and so on. So my tongue tip routinely loses contact with my lower teeth when I'm in a very open-mouthed E vowel, E. I'm not retracting the tip back into the body of the tongue. It's just hanging out, but it doesn't reach the teeth. If I try to make it reach the teeth, it doesn't tune as well. The resonator doesn't tune as well. So I've mentioned that in the book, that, you know, as long as the tongue is comfortable and you're getting the auditory target that you're after, don't worry about that. Even though, for most circumstances, your tongue will be at your lower teeth if it's not being retracted. So, yeah. And you'll see that of a lot of singers. You just watch their mouths. You will see, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had been on that idea a long time ago, for the better part of a decade, I think, particularly with my tenors singing high Cs on A vowels.
Yep.
like Boehm or something of this nature. Because I realized I was doing that. Like, my tip of my tongue was not there anymore. Yep. And then I watched some live videos of some other people doing it, and I was like, yeah, they're not doing it either.
Right.
And so that was not, when you introduced that idea, that was not a foreign concept to
right,
me.
Right, right.
Because that just kind of made sense, you know, just pedagogically, at least in some scenarios. You know, and now, if I'm being honest, most of the time, I think the tip of my tongue is on my lower teeth on an ah vowel, you know, and on other shapes. But I just thought that was a... That was something we needed to definitely hit on.
Right.
Now, talk to us a little bit. You know, in this edition, you did say that you've incorporated more of Ian's work and some of this stuff. So how did you incorporate that into the book? Like what concepts did you feel were really important that you felt like that you wanted to include in there?
I had already included a chapter on spectral tone color, but I just elaborated further and put more training, you know, uses of it in. And I probably elaborated a little bit more on auditory roughness in this one. And as you know, and you've pointed out, we've had conversations about this, auditory roughness, that's the buzz factor that starts arising when you have harmonic six and higher in the radiated sound, harmonics that are closer than a minor third together, the brain can't parse those as well. And the higher and closer together those harmonics get that are being radiated, the buzzier it sounds. Well, it turns out that the shallower the spectral slope, which means you have a lot of high, strong harmonics, the more potential auditory roughness there is in the sound, depending on how you're resonating that. That happens with greater, deeper vocal fold contact and longer vocal fold contact per cycle. So, which happens in chest voice, for example, or lower pitches where more of those high clustered harmonics are well within our strongest hearing range, which is the top octave of the piano. That's where we're most sensitive. So it turns out that auditory roughness is strongly correlated with laryngeal register, or at least perceived laryngeal register. So you can have a lot of auditory roughness and sound chesty, whether or not your laryngeal register is chesty. And exactly. So we can use the migration of auditory roughness from coarse, buzzy B-52 bomber low notes through a sort of a sizzly mix. Like mix is basically close timbre. Close timbre is basically in a mix to whoop, which is more smooth timbre with minimal to no auditory roughness or very subtle auditory roughness. And you can track and monitor the migration of auditory roughness as a way of indirectly training dynamic laryngeal registration across range. The other piece, and I hinted at this in the book, and now I'm coming out more strongly in subsequent presentations and basically saying that vocal registers in a well-modulated voice, meaning a voice that's trained to train away the yodel, you know, the sort of binary flip from a shallow spectral slope of raw chest to a very steep spectral slope of falsetto, if you've managed to smooth that so that it's a very gradual change in spectral slope, that you've eliminated the larynx from perceptual vocal register changes because it cannot feature individual harmonics. All it can do is make a clean signal or not. Clean signal means it's harmonics only. A dirty signal is noisy. So you got a clean signal, number one. And number two, if you train the voice to smoothly negotiate the shift from mode one to mode two so that there's not a sharp change in the spectral slope, but a subtle change in the spectral slope, you don't hear a strong enough shift of timbre to identify it as a register change. Now I'm going to rush to add, at the bottom of the treble clef and just below, because that's exactly where the shift from open timbre to close timbre occurs on your open vowels, that acoustic register overlays the laryngeal register shift. So you do hear a change in the auditory roughness there but it's as much due to the acoustic register change as it is to the laryngeal register change.
If not more.
Right, if not more, exactly. But other than that one, nowhere else in the range is there a binary shift in the spectral slope.
Correct.
In a well-trained voice. So every other timbral shift you hear across the range is due to acoustic registers.
That is exactly right. And it, you know, I've been talking about this same thing for years, too. I mean, right with you from the day I actually understood what you were talking about when you were talking about way back in the day, male voices turning over at the location roughly of the first vocal tract resonance. I basically present registration now as humans have to deal with whatever happens around E4 laryngeally. And if we understand how to negotiate that from a phonation standpoint, every other change that we encounter is some kind of acoustic shift somehow.
Yep.
That's absolutely right. Something I'd like you to talk a little bit about that has really started to impact my pedagogy is the idea that you sort of incorporated in from Ian's work with spectral tone color of the idea of vowels having sort of a target noise and another noise.
Right, complementary.
This is something that I've actually, interestingly, particularly, and I'm again going to say it, with my sopranos, has really started to factor into my teaching.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, a vowel is made, I mean, this is every model, as we know, and this also for me and other people, models are deliberately simplifications, but this model is simplification, but it's not that far off. Every vowel is made of at least two primary vowel colors, the tone colors being featured by the first resonance in the first formant and the second resonance, and I call that the under vowel and the over vowel, just because why? Under is lower and it's vowel-like. Over is higher and it's vowel-like. So under vowel and over vowel. So every vowel has an under vowel and an over vowel. Of those two, one of them is the intended target vowel in the word, and the other is a complementary modifying completing color. Most vowels, the target vowel is the over vowel. E, A, 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 A. But O and U, the under vowel is the target vowel color. That's because the spectral tone color of those vowels live in the treble clef where the first formant lives. So once you're aware, a vowel isn't just the target vowel sound. No, it's paint colors. Like you got this color and this color, and you're blending them together into a color. It's like blue and yellow, and you hear green, right? Because blue and yellow together is green. And you can play with the percentages of those colors once you do kinesthetic awareness of the using the counterscore to whisper, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's hugely useful for a singer to realize, I can make an ah shape and think through that ah shape, and my ah gets more comfortable and works better across my range. And vowels basically, as you go up the range, they basically migrate toward the complementary vowel color. And when you come down the range, they begin to come more towards the speech-like target vowel color.
And so that's really where I've started incorporating it with my sopranos.
Yep.
Because going toward that complementary color as we approach the top of the staff and then above really makes a huge difference, I find.
Yeah. And you can use the counterscore to whisper to maintain your concept of the vowel, like I was doing with the E earlier. So let's say, I'll take an E, because that one. So treble voices are going to have to start opening their vowels sooner than we non-treble voices have to. Why? They sing past their first resonance all day long. We only sing past the first resonance of E and U mostly. Our A and our O is on our high C. Okay, we don't sing past that very often. Okay.
No.
So, for example, so we don't have to open. We can open for other reasons. There are other modifications that we could play with, but the treble voices are opening when they get above the first resonance. They're going to open their mouth to track the sung pitch with the first resonance, and you can do the same thing by finding your target pitch. The more you open, you're hearing a lot of complementary vowel in that sound. You're not hearing but because you're still at that pitch. You're still making that pitch. There will be some color in that sound. there'll just be more complementary color blended with it, but it'll still be accepted as a, enough as an as they go higher or whatever the vowel is. So yeah. And for example, I just tell my treble voices, once you're in the treble clef and above, forget about ah. And actually you can find this in a lot of historic literature. Lotte Lehmann? Oh my gosh. She says, ahs, don't do ah, you know. There's
and
a lot of people. And yet you make an ah shape.
Yes. And what I think, and where so many of the younger singers that I encounter, where they've gotten into trouble, is the idea that they've been, unfortunately, and I'm not blaming anybody here.
Right.
This is not a blame thing. This
right.
has just been my experience. They've gotten into trouble by two ideas with that that have gotten them in trouble. Rather than experiencing what you're talking about, they've been told by choir directors, as soon as they get toward the top of the staff, just to sing ah all the time.
Yeah.
And they've been told to just drop their jaw more and more and more.
Right.
Yep. And then, am I right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a thing, right? That's, I'm not making that up.
Right.
And yet, that gets them into so much trouble because the mouth starts over-opening too soon, and and we have the wrong vowel color dominating, you know, the tone.
Right, yeah. Well, what's very interesting to me is that you can keep, I mean, I make this comment, I made this for a few years, that I have yet to meet a human being whose closed mouth is a vertical slit. Every human being I've ever known, when their mouth is closed, it's a horizontal slit. When you relax and open it, it still stays basically a horizontal oval. Mm-hmm. And it's just a sort of a mild expression. We're not even pulling it to the side. It just is lateral. This feeling that we've got to make this long, tall, vertical oval in order to sing round tones is this unfortunate mistake. Yes, we want the sound to have a certain round fullness. Absolutely.
Of course. Yeah, if we're training classical singers, absolutely.
Absolutely. But it's not, you don't have to round the mouth to get a round sound.
Yes.
You have to have a nicely set up pharynx, frankly, you know. Anyway, so I have my sopranos maintain a basically passive shape, which is basically like a lateral oval. It isn't lateralized. They're not pulling to the sides, just a pleasant, a light pleasant, and let the vowel migrate passively through that until you get near the top of the staff. Above the top of the staff, you're going to need to open that up. But you don't have to below that. It's a choice. Some do, and some do it very well. I admit that. But the ones that do it very well are doing it very well because they're doing the pharynx well, mm-hmm. not because they're opening their mouth in the front.
And I would add that it doesn't necessarily even have to just, it doesn't have to happen as soon as you're above the staff.
No.
Yeah.
It can even be delayed a little bit more toward the A.
Right. And what's curious is when I get them to do it the way I want, they get this really full, round sound that is, in dimension, is beyond the dimensions of their mouth.
Yeah.
It's like above and below and everywhere, but that's a percept, not a literal space.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but when they open the mouth, they tend to feel like they're making the whole space of the vowel with their oral cavity, and that gets them into the trouble.
That's it right there. That's it right there.
They've got to separate out those sensory feedbacks. The overall sensation of the tone is made up of a lot of things, you know, acoustic sensation, you know, all kinds of sensations, not just the literal shape sensation. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Great. Anything else from the book that is different this time that you want to point out or comment on?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there are six more chapters. There's a chapter on psychoacoustic and somatosensory perception. There's a chapter on the essential characteristics of Western classical bel canto singing, which I'm all about teaching all styles. Not that I teach all styles, but I think that's a very healthy development in our pedagogy, that we realize that the voice can make a lot of different sounds healthily, and they can be used for artistic expressive purposes. That said, my career has been primarily in the classical realm, and there are certain aspects of classical singing, leaving other styles out of it entirely that have not always been preserved the way I would like them to be preserved. Of course, this is an ancient conversation and an ancient complaint. But for example, vibrant singleness of pitch.
That's what I wanted you to hit on.
Yeah. Absolute legato and chiaroscuro balanced timbre. Vibrant singleness of pitch. By the way, I heard recently Will Crutchfield give an hour and a half lecture with demonstrations of singers from early in the last century to later and what's happened with vibrato. It was a brilliant lecture illustrating exactly what I'm talking about. So your Wagnerians in the early part of the last century had very quick, narrow vibrati and vibrant singleness of pitch. And now increasingly, not in every case, but in way too many cases, your heavy voiced dramatic singers have wobbles where they are not pitch centric. So basically, vibrant singleness of pitch, which I talked about in the first book, even in PVA, but I talk about it more here, is if the, and this came from a Sundberg paper some years ago, who was quoting an unpublished previous paper, a study that said, well, you know, when the vibrato rate and extent are within certain parameters, our brain can't track pitch vibrato. Pitch is our perception of frequency. So the frequency is undulating away at, you know, ideally around 6 per second. And the extent, how far above and below the target pitch that frequency is undulating is the extent or excursion. And if it's within certain parameters, our brains just hear a stable pitch. We hear one pitch. We don't hear an oscillating pitch. But we can tell something's lively about it, something sort of spinny or sparkly or buzzy about it. But our, when we really concentrate on, okay, what pitch am I hearing? We hear a stable pitch rather than a wah or even a nervous tremulous pitch. We hear a stable pitch. That is what I train for because I think it's the best function, number one. Number two, it's the most versatile. That kind of sound can cross over a lot of genres without creating a problem. So it works for classical, and it works for a lot of other styles. It even works for barbershop, where you want essentially the percept of a straight tone. You can have vibrant singleness of pitch in barbershop, and it works pretty well. You know, if you're really tuning a final barbershop chord and you want to really have a straight tone, you can do that. But if you have vibrant singleness of pitch, it works for Baroque. If you don't hear pitch waggle, you're fine, you know?
Right.
There are certain tunings of chords in harmonic settings that a straight tone has certain cool advantages for. But basically, anyway, so I mentioned that. So that's vibrant singleness of pitch. And that needs to be trained early on.
But I also think it's very important that you did point out, though, that while it could cross over styles, it doesn't have to cross over styles.
No, right.
Because,
right.
I mean, that was part of Christian and Daniel Zenger-Borch's paper on Freddie Mercury, was that their recreations of modeling Freddie Mercury was that the vibrato was not even or regular.
Right.
Which is what made his voice, one of the characteristics that made his voice interesting.
Right.
So it's such a good thing. But I mean, definitely, if we're training a Western classical singer, golly gee.
I would say even for most, certainly legit musical theater sounds.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's quite a
wide range of sounds that benefit from a vibrant singleness of pitch. That said, I mean, there are genres that want you to hear pitch vibrato.
Right.
Sustain a straight tone and then hear the vibrato come in late in the pitch.
Right.
Or Chinese opera is a deliberate waver of pitch.
Yeah.
So there's all, you know, there are other genres.
I was telling I just brought up Chinese opera in my class this week, and I was like, y'all don't know how powerful those voices are. I've seen it live in Beijing. Like,
well,
if you want to talk about a powerful noise, I have never heard a dramatic soprano who could equal that noise.
Wow.
It was loud and piercing, and
yep.
they
favor the high spectrum content.
Whoa!
Which makes it, whether or not it's actually more intense from a physical point of view, from a human perception point of view, it is.
Right. Yeah.
It is louder.
Yes. Right. Correct. Yeah. And it could just totally be the perception of it.
Right. But pharyngeal voice. That was another thing I included in.
Yes. Yes. Talk a little bit about, because did Ken talk about pharyngeal voice last time he was on? I think you had just started exploring witchy sounds.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Last time we had you on the podcast. You had read some of Cesare's stuff.
Right.
I know we talked some about it, but I can't remember if it was like on podcast or just in other settings.
Yeah.
If the listeners aren't familiar with that, go ahead and run us.
Well, it's been around a while, and I had always, as a classical teacher, I had always stayed away from it because whenever I would see someone, you know, the idea of using yan, yan, yan to get more ring in your sound has been around for a long time. And whenever I would see people do that, I would see them do a mouthy version that was in open timbre. And I would think, well, that's high larynx.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I don't think I want to go yeah, yeah, yeah. And then if you can cool your jets and realize there's probably intelligent life forms on the other side of an argument, you can learn things. So
that's the second soundbite. That's
the
second soundbite that I need to include in season 5 clip show.
Right. So I had a student that got interested in that, so I gave her the Chesery article that was published in England in the 50s, I think, of last century on pharyngeal voice, and she came back and said, "This is really interesting." So I started playing with it. I said, "Maybe there's something to this," because he was a classical teacher, and I realized, why do they call it pharyngeal voice? Well, these are all descriptive terms of somatosensory percepts, right? Chest voice, chest vibrations, head voice, head vibrations, pharyngeal voice. Huh, must be pharyngeal vibrations. What is that about? But it's this witchy bright timbre. This corresponds, by the way, to the major shift that I made after KVP1, after a conversation with the harmonic singer Wolfgang Zaus.
Brilliant.
And I said, because we tend to feel dark in the back and bright in the front, I think I sort of feel my first formant in my pharynx and my second formant in my mouth. And he said, "Oh no, it's just the opposite." I was depressed for 2 days. You know, this is knowledge sometimes hurts. Learning sometimes hurts. Oof. Because I had a paradigm that I had to rethink. And I said, "Well, I've always wondered why the Italians were saying that vowels are formed in the throat when it feels like yeah is very mouth oriented, right? It feels like the second formant, the brighter one, must be out in the front.
Except if you're whispering."
Yeah, if you're doing the chiaroscuro whisper.
Aha!
So I had to, all of these things came together in my thinking, and I realized, okay, I have to rethink this. I knew, which is still true, fortunately I was right about this all along, that all of the formants, they're not located in one place in the vocal tract.
No.
They vibrate, they're sound waves that resound or echo from lip to glottis through the entire length of the vocal tract at different frequencies.
Correct.
Okay? So I knew that. I was just talking about playing with perception. And he said, "Well, mouth opening raises the first formant." I already knew that. And it's still true that pharynx narrowing would raise the first formant too, and that is what I've been writing about, but I've been making that too dominant in the writing. In a classically trained voice where you leave the pharynx a little bit more neutral, it does change dimensions from vowel to vowel, mouth opening is the primary retuner of the first formant. And it turns out that the pharynx to the tongue dorsum height is the primary retuner of the second formant. So basically, the brighter overvowel is tuned in the back, and the darker, warmer undervowel is tuned to the front predominantly. That was a huge shift, and it has been golden.
And for me too. Oh my goodness. And I combine that with the idea of the vowel color that changes as we go up in the treble voice, and I combine those two ideas.
Yep.
And I don't know that I've actually seen anybody write on this yet, and I haven't heard any of us even really talk about it publicly, so I'm kind of nervous to say this because people are listening to this, and Perna doesn't. Listen, I'm not the expert that Ken is, and I'm definitely not the expert that Chadley Ballantyne is or Ian or whatever. However, I have a certain
You know a lot. Guy, go ahead.
With my musical theater treble voices, I've been taking that idea, and rather than the way I would track a soprano, I actually have them flip the vowel colors as they're going into a chest mix to belt. It really works wonderfully. If they also understand what it means in head voice, and as they're doing it in mode 2 in a more legit sound, when we go for the belt sound, and I'll do this with my tenors too when we're switching to musical theater, and we flip the idea, it really makes a difference, and it really opened up some possibilities for them. I've not seen any of us write on that or state it publicly, so I'm nervous to say it, but it's a definitely a pedagogic idea to play with.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to play with here and more to learn. Chadley talked about continuing to think of F2 to the front for CCM styles
exactly.
in conversation with me. What I do with that is I say, think of them as, I want to stay, and I'm not an expert in those other styles, so anything I say about that is take with a grain of salt. But I want to stay very pharyngeal in general with my orientation. I'll say more about that in a moment. But I want the pharyngeal orientation to be really ringy.
Yeah.
And so here's my latest. This is even past KVP2. I told you about it.
Okay, here's the news. Okay.
So I was already hinting in this direction, but I've just gone a little further with it. So the yawn, when you do the yawn, which I avoid completely, but a lot of teachers use it to raise the palate and lower the larynx. It backs the tongue in the back, and it creates a very, you know, dull, dominant, that gives you the dark back. It feels a distended, dark, woofy in the back. I'm now telling my singers, I want you to do the opposite of a yawn. Not a physical constriction, but I want you to feel like the oropharynx, which is the middle, you know, the right behind the mouth part. I want you to feel very concentrated and ringy right there.
Collected.
That thing there. And that, I think, has more potential for crossing over various genres.
I've done something like that for years. Do you know why? Yep. Because the first sound that you demonstrated tends to raise the larynx.
The yawn. Ah.
People don't think it does.
Yeah.
It tends to actually raise, when I'm working with a tenor or baritone or bass, and they go to that, the larynx tends to go right along with pitch. As pitch increases. They're doing that, the larynx goes up. And so I've done something similar to that for actually a very, very long time. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great stuff.
Yeah. What that does, in my view, is what I'm looking for is to sort of stabilize a good acoustic orientation in the pharynx so that when you go up and down the range, all the migrations can happen without it disturbing and yanking you around.
Yes.
And that thought of ringing in the back and very collected in the oropharynx enables you to do that, stabilize
Absolutely.
In a very comfortable way,
like
an expressive way. And I use expression, by the way, to do it. Like, very expressively motivated collection in the oropharynx.
Which I always admire about your teaching, and it's something also I was responding to in class yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
They were, of course, like, you know, I think they were expecting me. None of my current class studies with me. This is like a weird thing that my whole pedagogy class this fall, none of them are my students, which is kind of nice. But I think they were expecting me to, like, that if they walked into a lesson, that I would be like, okay, I need more first format like that. And I told them, like, I never use any language like that. And I've always been impressed with that in your teaching, particularly as we've gone to some of these affect ideas, trying to motivate sound from intention and emotion. And even though, and this is what I would say about it, the brilliance of watching you work is that I know, depending on what emotion or affect you're going for, there's an acoustic reason behind it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
May we all get there, Vocal Fam. May we all get to that point in our functional teaching. That's something that always has just really amazed me, Ken, about your teaching. That's just always been a wonderful thing about it. Okay, so they can get the book on Inside View Press. Mm-hmm. Website,
yes.
KVP2,
yes.
Amazon as well, or no? Does Scott have his books on Amazon?
Possible. You just have to be careful when you go elsewhere that you don't get the first version.
The first version, yes. Right. So, Kinesthetic Voice Pedagogy 2, Motivating Acoustic Efficiency, Ken Bozeman, publication date 2020, 2021.
It was just this
2021.
Year,
yeah.
Early this year.
It is not a hugely expensive text. You're not paying $400 for this book. It is honestly also a very quick read. It is not hard reading. You can read it very rapidly or just digest it at your pace. But Vocal Fam, listen, I say this very sincerely, and I've said this to Ken in my own words to him after reading the draft. This is Ken's magnum opus, y'all. This is a brilliant piece of pedagogic scholarship, and will go down, I think, beside those great books like Barbara Dosher's book and Jim McKinney's book and Vinard's book and Burton Coffin's book. This is in that lineage, and it just needs to be said here on the podcast.
You're very kind. I appreciate that.
Ken, what do you have coming up? You presenting anywhere? I know you're presenting this weekend.
Right. In a moment, my wife is presenting at the British Voice Association on Singing Through Change, this wonderful book area that she wrote with two colleagues. And then tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning here, 5 o'clock there, I'm doing a keynote presentation for the British Voice Association. So that's a fun thing, and then I'm taking a vacation for a period of time, if I can avoid the plague, while we travel around a bit. And a year from now, a year from August, I am keynoting at the International Congress of Voice Teachers in Vienna. And God, please let that happen live. I really want to go to Vienna.
Yes. Well, you know. I really want Chicago to happen live.
Well, yeah,
that
right.
Too.
Yeah.
Don't we all, Sarah?
Yes, yes. I would love to get to go to one of these conferences in person.
Exactly.
Because Sarah, at this point, has like met so many of our colleagues.
But it's all over Zoom.
Yeah.
And has not been to a national conference yet. Well, she was the Voice Foundation. But not to... there's nothing quite like Nats National. There's just nothing quite like Nats National.
Dream.
And I think the program should be out in the next month. And it's just... hopefully Chicago happens.
Yeah.
Definitely
hopefully,
Vienna.
Hopefully Vienna happens.
I don't blame you. I'd want to go there, too.
We've got I've got a couple of papers in for Chicago, or presentations in for Chicago. One with Sarah and one with Josh and Yvonne.
Great.
And Josh and Yvonne and I sent ours to Vienna as well. So hopefully we're all going to be together next summer.
That would be great.
Are we hoping for an in-person a reopening of NEC Acoustic Vocal Pedagogy?
We are hoping for that. It will go forward hybrid, even if it's in person, because we've realized that some people just can't afford to get there, because there are people that are like from six different countries the last time we did it, all around the globe, chiming in, even in odd hours, their own time. Well, if you do a virtual and you save the recordings, they can watch them whenever they can watch them. But so we will go forward hybrid, but we hope to really be hybrid, actually be in person and
some people in the room.
Right, because it's what really needs to happen with all of these ideas is you need to see it put into bodies. You need to see it demonstrated in real time in bodies to realize, oh, yeah, I know that sound. I've heard that sound before. That's how you do that? That's a better way to get there? Great. You know, it's not like we're not inventing some new way to sing here. We're just, you know, figuring out better strategies to get more of us there quicker.
And that was literally practically our quote, Sarah, from the article, right? Our quote was that in order to teach voice, you don't need to know a thing about this acoustic stuff.
No.
But it could make you a better teacher faster.
Yep, exactly.
And that's really it, Vocal Fam. Ken, anything you and Joanne have been binging over the COVID year and a half now?
Oh goodness! Well, of course we retired from our teaching posts, but we've had to learn. I thought, you know, I'll try to go down to Chicago, maybe do a studio there and here there. Well, no, I'm doing them all from home, of course, virtually.
Yep.
And what's been sort of fun for me as a person that whose entire career was basically teaching vocal babies. My undergraduates, who were lovely. I loved it. But no graduate program, right? I've been teaching grown-ups. I've been teaching young professionals around the globe that needed to work out posagy issues or whatever, and had run across my work and thought I might be able to help them. And that's been kind of fun to work at that level of singer, as well as the number of teachers that just want to take on board this information. And the best way to take it on board is to take it literally on board in their own bodies
That's right.
To play with. So I've been doing a good bit of that, as has Joanne has done some of that, and she's gotten a lot of presentations on this subject, because there are a lot of female-bodied singers who eventually go through hormonal transitions that they need to know what's going to happen or what might happen and how do I deal with it. And so she's getting a lot of interest on that, as well she should, as also her co-authors are getting.
Yeah, that's sort of thing. Kate Fraser Neely, Nancy Boz, and,
right.
and Joanne Bozeman, who wrote Singing Through Change, which is probably available at Amazon and
yep. Singing Through Change, Women's Voices in Midlife, Menopause, and Beyond. Absolutely. And there's a great Facebook page with over 2,000 members, including SLPs, ENTs,
yeah.
singers. It's amazing conversation.
Yeah, I actually directed. I had someone who I was working through some things a couple years back, yep. and I had directed them to the Facebook group, and they found that helpful because there was just, you know, camaraderie.
A lot of resource there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Sarah, what'd you have for breakfast?
Muffins.
Muffins, perfect.
It's exciting
Absolutely.
Day.
It's Friday. Sarah and I have opera auditions this afternoon, Vocal Fam. We are excited to actually masked, albeit, but live and in a big hall.
Yes.
And we are excited about it. Listen, Vocal Fam, there's lots of opportunities for you out there. If you are a NATS member, please check out the National Mentoring opportunity. Ken, are you one of those teachers? I am. I don't know if you're on that list or not for the National
Mentoring. I don't actually know. That's a good question.
Okay.
I was at the last convention. I did some mentoring, so if that put me on the list, whatever.
But anyway, if you'd like to do some mentoring, check out that list. There's a ton of great experienced teachers on there who could, you know, talk with you for a very small fee. It's very affordable, and that's on the NATS website. Also, just, you know, if you're a NATS board member right now, may the peace of the Lord be with you all as you make
exactly.
decisions about whether we're going to do in-person auditions this fall or not. I know that we're all having these discussions, and it's a weird time. And also, just to everybody out there in Vocal Fry Land, please, 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 let's not give up the faith here. We're going to get through this at some point. I promise that COVID is going to be behind us at some point, even though this recent surge has not felt like it. So please, from Perna and nobody else who's on this podcast, please get vaccinated.
Add me to that list. Yep.
Okay.
Get vaccinated.
So from us, please get vaccinated. Although I have a feeling if you listen to this show, most of you are.
You probably are, yeah.
So anyway, we love you, and just let's keep moving forward. All right, Ken, well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
It is always our honor and our pleasure to consider you a friend of the podcast. And,
it's mutual.
Thank you so much. And we will, you know, talk to you again very soon, okay? All right. Peace out, Vocal Fam.
Bye.